seems like every time you turn around, it's Monday. And it seems like the same stories, the same events continue to repeat themselves again and again and again. We've talked a lot about stem cell research and human cloning here on Issues, etc. There it goes again. In California, an initiative to fund with taxpayer money, as though that state were not already deep enough in debt, a very questionable stem cell research bill. We'll be talking about that with Wesley Smith here in the first few minutes of this hour of Issues, etc. Also, we'll get an update on basically the legal meanderings of the Terry Schindler Schiavo case down in Florida from Wesley in just a few minutes as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. The rest of the hour, let's see, in the last 25 minutes, Dr. Gene Rudd joins us for a few minutes to talk about a new report from the Center for Disease Control on the prevention of a specific type of sexually transmitted disease. You know what the CDC has said? Abstinence is the best way to prevent it. Boy, these people have big degrees. I mean, these people went to medical school. Same thing my mom told me when I was in high school. It works every time it's tried, says Rush Limbaugh. Also, the Christian Medical Association has a few things to say about the morning after pill. We'll spend the second part of this first hour talking about that. Then we've got open lines for 90 minutes, a lot to talk about. Here's the first question I've got for you. I have many questions and things to say during that 90 minutes of open lines, but the first one has to do with George W. Bush. He was interviewed this weekend. Was it Meet the Press? He was interviewed on one of the Sunday morning programs. He was asked a question about religious freedom in the future Iraq. He sounded confident that there would be religious freedom. We'll hear from the president during the first part of Open Lines, Issues, etc., starting in the second hour on religious freedom. The question I have for you is this. How important for you is the issue of religious freedom in the future Iraq? Does your support for the war, the ongoing war effort, hinge in any way whatsoever upon what happens in Iraq when a stable government is finally established and whether or not that government is just another Islamic state with no religious freedom to speak of or a state with religious freedom where Christianity and Islam and all the other religions have equal protection under law? George W. Bush says he says there will be religious freedom. It will not be an Islamic state. If it is, if it turns out to be just another Islamic state, will we have wasted our time? That's the first question for Open Lines. Others will follow as well. And then, in the last 25 minutes of the program, Pastor Ben Ball of St. Luke Lutheran Church in Dedham, Massachusetts, will be talking to him and getting his pastoral perspective on gay marriage in that state. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Oh, also during Open Lines, two pictures that caught my eye in the paper. One is of a Baptist pastor with very strange hair. You might have seen it. And the other is of Senator John Kerry in a very similar setting. His hair looks normal. He's standing in the pulpit of a Baptist church. I'm going to bring this up again. I'm going to keep bringing it up, because I keep on seeing pictures of politicians in pulpits. We'll talk about that during Open Lines. Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you?
I'm doing well, but I feel like I'm in the Titanic here in California, and I'm beginning to throw up the flares and toot the horn, hoping some ship will come by and save us.
Well, I tell you what, it doesn't surprise me, but as a Californian, you have written very recently on this $3 billion, you call it a pork barrel project to fund scientifically problematic and morally controversial research into human cloning. Tell us what has you concerned.
This is one of the most audacious and hubristic money grabs I've ever heard about. You have people from big biotech, from the major academic research centers, some of their Hollywood rich friends like Christopher Reeve and others, who are trying to qualify and, in fact, plan to spend $20 million in this state qualifying a bond initiative and constitutional amendment for the November ballot that would require, under the California Constitution, my state voters, my state citizens, to borrow through bonds $3 billion over 10 years 295 million of which would have to, by law, be given to biotech research each year, regardless of the state of the economy, and that research would be put into human cloning for therapeutic cloning and embryonic stem cell research, which would receive a priority because the proposal states the federal government isn't adequately funding these issues without limitations. That means that even if adult stem cells, which are clearly showing themselves to be the apparently the better approaches to regenerative medicine, even if that continues, the priority must be to those which are underfunded, meaning that we now have politics deciding funding as opposed to merit. And this is at a time when my state is tens of billions of dollars in debt. This March, we have two bond issues on our ballot, one $15 billion, which is just to try to consolidate debt we've accumulated over the last 2 years, and another a $12 billion bond issue to try to help repair our dilapidated schools. And these people want, and we have poor children being thrown out of health coverage, schools closing down, our roads can't be fixed. I go over a bay bridge a couple of times a week that may fall into the ocean if there's an earthquake, and these people want us to borrow $3 billion to give to them to do cloning research.
I note that the title, or at least the popular title of this thing, is California STEM Research and Cures Act.
Of course, because what they are doing throughout the country, and not just in California, is big biotech and the academic researchers who have the philosophy of scientism are redefining terms. What used to be called therapeutic cloning is no longer called cloning. It's now called somatic cell nuclear transfer for stem cells. Yet at the same time, the same procedure, SCNT, which made Dolly the sheep, if it's used to create a baby, is called cloning because they're trying to separate out the same act for the different purposes and trying to fool the American people as to what it's really about. What they don't tell people is that the research that they are advocating taxpayers fund, and not just in California, also in New Jersey and other places, would also be the exact kind of research necessary to learn how to create reproductive clones, cloned babies. So this is all a huge hubristic grab by bioscientists and academic researchers to dominate society, to take this issue through obfuscation and through half-truths and falsehoods to transform it into merely a science issue instead of also a very important moral and ethical issue.
If the taxpayers in California should be funding any kind of research into stem cells, what research actually does have merit? What actually does deserve further inquiry?
Well, first, I have to say, I don't think it is up to the state to fund medical research. We do not have the money for that. I don't think any state does. I mean, it's up to the state to provide basic services to people. You know, the federal government has the National Institutes of Health, which funds research. And there's also a lot of private research money and venture capital that goes into some of these areas of endeavor. And you find that the private money is overwhelmingly going to adult stem cell and related forms of research, because they know, I believe, that if there's going to be profits made from this regenerative medicine that we're trying to develop, it's going to be through those non-controversial avenues, which are already in human trials. And the reason that the biotech hegemonists, if you will, are trying to get Californians to, and you can just see the ads, can't you, Todd? Christopher Reeve coming on television saying, vote yes on Proposition 84, and I can walk again. I mean, that's what's going to happen. They want us to borrow $3 billion to give to them because they can't get private venture capital to fund cloning research because it's impractical, it's controversial, and it probably is not going to work in the same way, or certainly not as quickly, as adult stem cells will appear to be heading, because we're already in early human trials with adult stem cells. We've got early human trials for curing heart disease or treating heart disease. Overseas, they're doing human trials in Lou Gehrig's disease. They're doing it in Alzheimer's disease. There have been studies in human trials in multiple sclerosis. In animal studies, we've been able to get animals with severed spinal cords to walk again using hormones that stop the creation of scar tissue that is what appears to be what prevents spinal injuries from healing themselves. So, I mean, tremendous efforts are being made to completely moral efforts of research funded federally and privately. And these other things, for example, therapeutic cloning, now renamed somatic cell nuclear transfer for stem cells, isn't ever going to be widely available to most people, even if it can work, because you'd never have enough human eggs. In fact, there was a study published by the National Academy of Sciences that said just to get the just to pay for the human eggs required to get one embryonic stem cell line from a clone of a patient would take $200,000, which means you're talking about this only being available to the very, very rich if it can be done or under a strict rationing regimen. And that's not what people are being told by these proponents who want to get the taxpayers' money into their own pockets so they can do research they want to do.
Why is it that big biotech doesn't follow what would appear to be the fiscal path of least resistance and the morally less dubious path and say, look, let's get into adult stem cell research because it seems far more fruitful and it does not have the moral problems that embryonic stem cell research does? Why do they continue to press for something that is research-wise unfruitful and morally problematic?
That's an interesting question. First of all, they are pursuing it at the adult stem cell level. That's where a lot of these discoveries are coming from. The biotech industry, with a lot of private money and a lot of private businesses, plus the, you know, a lot of the universities now are no longer, you know, they're no longer worried about you've heard the term publish or perish, right?
Right.
Where if you're a academic researcher, in order to maintain your tenure, to get tenure and then to maintain your respectability, you have to publish in learned journals and share knowledge. Well, that's quickly becoming patent or perish, because in the life sciences now, universities are attaching themselves to private industry to help fund their university centers. And so you find that if a researcher comes up with a biotech breakthrough, before they publish it, they patent it, or they form corporation, a biotech corporation, from which they hope to get rich. It's like if Einstein had created a Relativity R Us corporation instead of doing his work from Princeton in a learned fashion and satisfied with his salary and his speaking engagements and money he made from writing. But they are doing that. And what I think is driving this is a real ideology that is known as scientism, which basically holds that science is the source of salvation, that only scientists can say what is moral and ethical in science, and that the jobs of the rest of us is to provide them with tax money to do their research and mind our own business. But these are not just science issues. These are also moral and ethical issues. And as I've said repeatedly on your show, the local barber, the school teacher, the homemaker, and the talk show host has as much right to weigh in on these moral and ethical issues and consider these and try to promote a societal standard as do researchers and scientists.
Wesley, finally on this subject, how big a role will big biotech be playing in the upcoming presidential campaign?
I'm not sure how big a role in the sense of a direct sense. You certainly have lobbyists spending tens of millions of dollars. You're going to have PACs contributing to campaigns. But as to which side I think most of these people will be on, President Bush is bitterly resented for having refused to fully fund embryonic stem cell research, which, as you'll recall, was the first big controversy of his administration back in 2001. They also, I believe, will try to obtain from a Democratic President Kerry or a Democratic President Dean not only full funding for embryonic stem cell research, which they have all promised to provide, but they will then redefine human cloning, when not for the purpose of making a baby, into stem cell research so that cloning would also be fundable by taxpayer money. And don't forget that in New Jersey, a law is now in effect that permits human cloning, implantation, and gestation through the ninth month, only requiring the destruction of the cloned human at the point of birth.
Wesley Smith is our guest. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of several books, including The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. If you'd like to join us, we do have call-in number 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. On this next issue, we've talked many times, Wesley, and it seems to be just round and round the mulberry bush with Terry Schindler-Schiavo and the judges and other legal authorities who are in charge of her case. You've written recently about what you call a mockery of the rule of law in Terry's case. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, when I found this out, I was just outraged. I did a little bit of research on some of the Florida statutes that apply to guardianship, because I had been told by Pat Anderson, who is the attorney for the Schindlers, who are Terry's parents, that the judge had not required Michael Schiavo, the guardian, to file what's called a guardianship plan and a guardianship report for Terry for several years. So I looked into that, and I found that the very heart and soul of Florida's statutory scheme, or plan is a better term, for protecting vulnerable and helpless people like Terry who are wards in a guardianship, is that each year the guardian has to file with the court, and this is mandatory in the law, has to file with a court a statement reporting about what happened in the previous year, and then a plan for the forthcoming year about caring for the ward. And that would include what are the medical needs of the ward, what are the therapeutic needs of the ward, what are the housing needs, you know, the social service needs and that kind of thing of the ward. Then present a plan to fulfill those needs for the court to approve, and if the court is satisfied, the court approves it. If the court is dissatisfied, then the court might require other aspects to be added to the plan. And it is only when the court has approved the plan that the guardian has authority to act on behalf of the ward, and then only within the parameters of the plan that has been approved. But since 2001, Judge Greer has not required Michael Schiavo to file a report or a plan. Michael has repeatedly asked for extensions. These have been repeatedly granted to 6 times now. So what would be the use of filing a guardianship plan for July 2001 through June 2002? It's moot. It's over. It's history. And there is not a current plan in effect because the judge is not forcing and requiring Michael to fulfill the basic obligation of a ward in Florida. To the point that as I read those statutes, I don't believe Michael Schiavo, while he is technically the guardian, he has no power to act on behalf of Terry because there is no court-approved plan in place at this time. And this is a material breach of Judge Greer's obligation to apply the law of Florida, and nobody will do anything about it. And I am just flipping out.
It's important that you note, and you've already described this, but I want you to return to that these reports, this review of the guardianship plan and of the guardian's authority to act on the behalf of the ward, in this case, Michael Schiavo, on behalf of his wife, Terry Schiavo, who is in, he says, a persistent vegetative state. This is done by the court prospectively. That is, right. They want to review it in advance of its activity, not retrospectively.
Right. Well, you have 2 aspects. You have the report, which reports to the court of what happened in the last year to make sure that the guardian fulfilled his or her obligations under the plan. And then you also have the annual plan that the judge is then to review for the coming year, prospectively. Since June 30th, 2001, when the last plan expired, there has been no plan in effect approved by the court. There have been no reports filed, even telling the court officially, according to Florida statute, what has been done. Under the Florida statute, as I read it, and it was very clear, this must be done, not shall be done or may be done. It must be done, and it is the act of approving of the plan by which the guardian gains the authority to act on behalf of the ward, and then only within the parameters permitted by that plan. What's happening instead is that the courts of Florida and Michael Schiavo are treating Terry as if she's already dead, so why go through the bother of doing the protective plan and have going through the effort to approve it?
Do you think that's what's really behind? Because this all
comes
back to Judge Greer.
Her life isn't worth living. She's as good as dead. We're going to dehydrate her anyway as soon as we get past Terry's law. So what's the point? I think that's exactly what's going on.
So we've got Judge Greer basically selectively applying and selectively either ignoring major portions of Florida law.
He has given requested extensions, which I do not believe are authorized under Florida law, at least as I looked at it. I mean, I suppose you could have a continuance of a week or two, you know, that in case something happened. But 3 years? It's ridiculous. And he is refusing to require Michael Schiavo to abide by statutory law. I think that is an act of malfeasance of the worst kind, because basically what Judge Greer has said, in effect, is even though the Florida law provides for this essential protection for all wards in Florida, Terry Schiavo is not going to receive it, and now she's off having a guardian controlling her life without any legal authority under Florida law. It is the most, I mean, if you see my hair, I look like Einstein right now. My mind is so blown. As a lawyer, my mind is so blown.
Finally, as an addendum to this story, with only about a minute here before we have to go, Michael Schiavo was in 1993 giving a deposition in which it was further evidence that he does not consider Terry's life worth prolonging. He hardly considers her to be his wife any longer. Tell
right.
us about that.
Yeah. I finished reading this deposition finally because there's so many files in this case, and I was just amazed. He was asked in this deposition taken in 1993, because the parents were trying to get guardianship from him because he refused antibiotics for Terry, what had happened to Terry's wedding ring and engagement ring. And he said, I took them and I melted them down and I made a ring for myself. He also put her cats to sleep. This was also at a time when he was pretending to be a wonderful, loving husband, but was sleeping around with a lot of other women. So there you go.
Wesley Smith, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books. One is Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Now you can read two of Wesley's recent columns. One is titled The Rule of Terry's Case Strikes Again. We were just talking about that. And the other one, titled California Cloning May Be Coming Soon. You can read both of them on Wesley's website, WesleyJSmith.com. WesleyJSmith.com. For the remainder of this hour, when we come back from this break, two things to discuss with Dr. Gene Rudd. He is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. We're going to talk about a new report by the Centers for Disease Control on the prevention of a specific type of sexually transmitted disease. Their answer? Abstinence. And we'll be talking about the morning after pill. That's for the remainder of this hour of Issues, Etc. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on your children or other kids you know. The prayer is that they'll develop a passion for sharing Christ around the world. Some easy ways to get your children interested in missions includes helping them make connections with service projects in your church. Stay updated on one or two international news events and pray with your family for the people who are impacted. Another resource is the Worldwide Kids Club, a group of children and young people who are dedicated to going into all the world and preaching the gospel. Log on to www.worldwidekidsclub.com for mission tips and mission-oriented songs, and continue to pray that no matter what career your child chooses, that they'll use their talents in Christ's global service. Get more information at worldwidekidsclub.com or call 1-800-804-9524. That's 1-800-804-9524.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. All creatures that have breath and motion, wrote the poet John Menser. Our dog Speaker has breath, but not a whole lot of motion. When Speaker does move, it's either to lie in front of the vent to get hot air in winter or cold air in summer, or Speaker moves to beg for food. The Bible doesn't speak very favorably about dogs, caricaturing them as wild, vicious scavengers. There is, however, one hint dog lovers welcome. A woman said to Jesus, "The dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Matthew 15:27. So perhaps some dogs were domesticated. At least for that woman, the dog served as a reminder of the goodness of God for all people. The Westminster Dog Show begins this evening, and Diane and I will be watching. Speaker will too, his ears perking up when he hears barking. We'll be reminded again what a marvelous creation this is. All creatures that have breath and motion, that throng the earth, the sea, the sky, now join me in my heart's devotion. Help me to raise God's praises high. My utmost powers can ne'er aright declare the wonders of His might.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, www.bethanylcms.org. We recently got an email from a listener, Ellen. She wrote this: "I'm a devoted listener who wants to thank you for your dedication to keeping us informed on the Terri Schiavo case. So many people want to do something to save her life after hearing the details of this horrible situation, and your program helps to spread the word. I think that those of us who get very upset about it need your help every so often to reassure us that others care too and that actions are being taken. It's possible that because of the coverage of the case on KFUO featuring that fine Christian soldier Wesley Smith, just had him on here, people are being enlisted to take actions that will make all the difference for Terri and for the many thousands of disabled persons she represents. I was one of the many who emailed Governor Jeb Bush in Florida and other officials about the case. I thought you would like to know once again that your listeners do act in a variety of ways on the information you provide. I just want you and the staff to know that the team is out here doing stuff, not just luxuriating in the pleasure of listening to you or your wonderful guests every day, and we do appreciate you." Folks, in order to bring you just the half hour that we did with Wesley Smith here on Issues Etc., it took a full-time producer to do the research, to look into the things, to find the stories, to make the phone call to Wesley Smith and set it up, schedule everything. It takes an engineer sitting across from me as we speak to make sure that everybody is accessed, my microphone is on, and everything's running smoothly. It takes me sitting here for 3 hours a day, the research that I do in advance of the interviews as well. Not to mention, we just did 25 minutes of long distance to California, and we do that on a regular basis. This is not cheap. This also requires your support. Issues Etc. is entirely listener-supported. And if you appreciate Issues Etc. stance as we defend life from beginning to end and the programs that we provide, I want to encourage you to take advantage of our new Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It is a level giving, a monthly giving program that we just started at the end of 2003, it's already shown a good measure of success. Three levels of giving to suit whatever level of generosity you're comfortable with. The first is the confessor level, $25 a month or $250 a year. And in thanks for that, we will send you an Issues Etc. journal subscription, an Issues Etc. tape of the month, and the book by Craig Parton, The Defense Never Rests. The next level up is the apologist level, $50 a month, $500 annually. You get all the benefits of being a confessor, plus a quarterly Issues Etc. book of the month. That's four books during the course of the year. And then at the level of the reformer, $100 a month or an annual gift of $1,000. You'll have all the benefits of being a confessor and an apologist. You'll get three Issues Etc. journal subscriptions, two Issues Etc. tapes of the month, a written transcript. You can go over it in detail at your leisure. Lie in bed, read the transcript of the Issues Etc. tape of the month, and an Issues Etc. book of the month for all 12 months. Now, we are a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We are not funded by the church body. We are supported by listeners like you. You can donate by credit card. Call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. You can also donate by check. Write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The address again, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. And you can now donate online as well at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find a way to donate online and information on the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Dr. Gene Rudd joins us for the remainder of this hour. Two issues to talk about. The first is a new report by the Centers for Disease Control on the prevention of a certain type of STD, and we'll be talking a little bit later about the morning after pill. Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. Dr. Rudd, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks, Todd. Good to be with you.
What has the CDC recently reported with regard to human papillomavirus?
Well, the CDC has basically come out and said what the scientific literature has been proposing or showing for the last several years, and that is that condoms don't protect against human papillomavirus. Essentially, it doesn't offer any protection. And not only that, the condoms don't protect effectively against some of the other diseases. They might offer partial protection, but not complete protection. So I'm really hoping that this will be the first or the second or third nail in the coffin on the myth that somehow safe sex means something you do when you're having sex. Safe sex really is about making a choice to have one lifetime sexual partner, and we often call that marriage fidelity.
Dr. Rudd, I think my mom told me this when I was a teenager.
You know, mine did too, and we need more moms and dads telling teenagers that. The whole thing about abstinence is there was a study that the AMA looked at in order to pass a resolution encouraging safe sex education, not abstinence-based education. They looked at a study that was done in the inner city among youth that were already sexually active, and they did a randomized study. The study was designed nicely. They just picked a skewed population. And they looked to say, well, you know, the abstinence only did have some effect for out to about 3 months, and then it lost its effectiveness. If we just tell them, you know, over a short period of time that you need to be abstinent for about 3 months, they do pretty good, but then they fall back into their old habits. And based on that, and based on the fact that the safe sex curriculum folks did tend to have higher condom use for up to 6 months after that, they concluded that the safe sex education curriculum was better than the abstinence-based education curriculum. But what's wrong with this message? You got a bunch of kids who are already sexually active, who are constantly being bombarded by their culture and their peers and everything they hear that sexuality's okay, and then they get a short lecture in school that says abstinence is a better alternative. Well, my goodness, I think 3 months of changed behavior is really good to talk about and to applaud. They need to hear this unified message repetitively over and over, just like our parents did for us, and it does change behavior. And there's good data to show that.
How serious a problem is human papillomavirus, HPV?
Well, when you figure 3 million, if you say that the definition of a plague is a serious disease that lots of people in culture have, then we have a modern-day plague. Because we're seeing, you know, 3 million of our teenagers are infected already with sexually transmitted diseases. That's just the teenagers. We're already having over 5 million people infected by human papillomavirus each year and over 20 million cases. It's not just a teenage disease. It affects everyone. So we're talking about large numbers of people being infected with this, that with the symptoms ranging anywhere from having disfiguring warts all the way up to death from cancer.
You mentioned before, you didn't call it this, but I've heard it called abstinence plus, kind of tossing a bone to the abstinence advocate, saying, yeah, we teach abstinence plus safe sex. Does that send a mixed message?
Well, it does send a mixed message. Unfortunately, if you go and survey these abstinence plus programs, you will find that there's safe sex myth being taught in that. It's not, the emphasis is not on abstinence, and people have gone out and surveyed the schools that are actually teaching that. Fortunately, a small minority of people, of schools, are teaching this abstinence plus concept. It is the sheep in wolf's clothing, or it's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Now, we're talking here about human papillomavirus, but it seems as though the same behavior that would permit the spread of that would permit the spread of just about any STD.
Well, it does, and condoms, as we've mentioned, has no effect on preventing the spread of human papillomavirus because of the nature of sexual contact and the skin-to-skin contact and so forth. But condoms also only have about an 85% effectiveness in stopping the spread of human immunovirus, which is AIDS. Now, the importance there is like playing Russian roulette. I mean, it's the same as taking a six-shot revolver and putting one bullet in the chamber, spinning the barrel, spinning the chamber, and pulling the trigger. That's about the same statistics as you got using condoms to protect yourself, the same risk of getting it from somebody who's HIV-infected and you have sex with them. I just don't think that message is getting across to our young people, our society in general, that condoms don't offer any better protection than that. And condoms also only work, depending on which study you read, between 25 and 75% effective in stopping the spread of gonorrhea and syphilis. So we're talking about some major significant diseases that plague our young people that we're, you know, it's like telling my son, don't speed, but if you do, please slow down at the corner of 5th and Main because that's where a cop sits. What kind of message is that? It's really an endorsement to go ahead and speed, and maybe he'll remember to slow down at that one point in time, but all the rest of the time he's putting himself and others at risk of their life because he's speeding.
So beyond the moral arguments that are so easily made here with regard to abstinence and marriage, there is solid medical thinking in favor of advocating abstinence and marriage.
Absolutely. You know, I think the proof is in the pudding. What we want to do is decrease the number of young people having sex, and there's a trend showing that since the abstinence-based programs have been in school, where all the studies have been indicating more than 50% of teenagers 15 to 19 were sexually active. Now the numbers are down as low as 46 or 43%, either one of those two studies you want to look at. It's dropped below 50%. That's a trend in the right direction. And there was really an important study last year in the Journal of Adolescence and Family Health. And it's a study that looked at why there's a decline in the birth rate, the teenage pregnancy rate and the teenage birth rate. And you know what their conclusion was?
What's that?
Abstinence. It's the emphasis on abstinence education in the schools that is having a long-term impact on young people to change their behavior and change the unwanted pregnancy rate in our country.
The next generation, I'm thinking about the 20 million that are infected with HPV. They may know it, they may not know it. They will be reaping the sad benefits, some of them, of that, some of it less extreme, some of it very extreme.
You know, 4,000 cases of cervical cancer death per year in this country due to HPV.
The next generation, their children, will have seen that plague and its consequences firsthand.
What is the Christian Medical Association doing to extend the message of abstinence, not just to this generation trying to catch those who are falling through the cracks, but to the very next generation as well?
What we're trying to do is to make sure that our policymakers, our lawmakers, those in Congress and the White House understand this. And fortunately, it seems that we have a president who does. Whether you like him or not on many other issues, I think you got to like him on this because, he took the time in his State of the Union address to mention that this was an important problem and that he wanted something done about it. He took the time to write into the new federal budget increased funding for abstinence-based programs. And we've been there, being the amen corner the whole way and making sure that the lawmakers, policymakers understood the facts on this. And also, we have been in a very active mode of helping our members understand the importance of this education in the doctor's office and to the parents of these children. And we believe in this so much that our national convention this summer, we got Patricia Shulak coming, who is one of the authorities on abstinence-based programs, and she's going to be a keynote speaker at our national convention this year. It's been something important to us.
Finally, on that subject, make the case, not for abstinence plus or abstinence along with something else, but abstinence only as good social policy.
Well, God figured this out long before we did. And if God figured it out, it's got to be good social policy. I think that's the common denominator for we who are believers. But if you just step back and you say you don't buy into this biblical principle, if you look at the data and look at what has happened in the face of abstinence-based programs and look at the longitudinal change in behavior and outcome and lower risk and lower sexual involvement, lower unwanted pregnancies and decreasing a sexually transmitted disease in these age groups, then you say, hey, this is working. And do we want to propagate this plague into future generations, as you mentioned, and or have the misery of those in this current generation having to deal with these diseases? I think the answer is no. To do something different is to, an analogy might be to say you got somebody with an overeating disorder and an overweight problem and say, well, let's put you on a lipid-lowering drug and let that be our way of dealing with this. We would laugh at that. We know it takes a much bigger, you got to go back to the behavioral problem that leads to the disease. And until we go back to the behavioral problem, that's the wrong use of our sexuality, we're not going to conquer this problem.
Dr. Gene Rudd is our guest, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Rudd, another story recently out near the very end of 2003, the Christian Medical Association is calling for informed consent and, in particular, lauding certain legislators' urging of the FDA to think seriously before they approve the over-the-counter sale of the morning-after pill. What is the morning-after pill?
Well, it's a misnomer, first we should say. The morning-after pill is better called hormonal emergency contraceptive. And the reason that morning-after pills are incorrect is because technically the drug's better taken immediately and then 12 hours later, and you can take it up to 72 hours, according to the FDA guidelines, up to 72 hours after unprotected intercourse. So the morning after is not critical in terms of the point in time. It's better called emergency contraceptives. And, there's a place for people who accept that contraceptives have a place in society, and not everybody does, but, for those large number of people who believe that there's a place for contraceptives, this does have an ethical place. In those situations in which you know that you're using it to stop ovulation, the release of the egg, and not to interrupt the early development process, and we can pretty well determine those differences, there is a place for that. The concern about this product being released over the counter is it goes back to this whole thing of what do we want to do in society? Do we want to encourage people to have more high-risk sexual behavior or less? Making this product available over-the-counter is going to encourage more high-risk sexual behavior. For an example, if you're a young woman and you're debating whether to have high-risk sexual behavior tonight or not, am I more or less likely to make the decision to have high-risk behavior if I think I can take a pill tomorrow that that will eliminate the consequences of the behavior tonight? Well, the answer is intuitive. Also, I think the most serious concern about making this product available over the counter is it's removing the patient from the environment in which they can get the best care, the best counseling, deal with the basic issue of misuse of our sexuality, screen for those sexually transmitted diseases. It's taking the patient away from the doctor. Most young women go to doctors for the primary reason of getting a contraceptive. We know that these are high-risk groups. Our professional societies are already telling us that you need to screen them once or twice a year for sexually transmitted diseases because a fourth of these young teenagers are going to have sexually transmitted diseases. But now we're saying, well, we'll take away the main motive for them going to the doctor by giving them this emergency contraceptive over the counter. I think we're heading for a disaster if we do that.
One of my concerns, I have a teenage daughter, and one of my concerns is that this drug has not been adequately tested on teenagers, and yet that group is the primary market if this were to be an over-the-counter drug available there in the drugstore.
Todd, that's a legitimate concern. If you extrapolate some of the other safety issues that are known about this drug, it's a lesser concern for me. It is a concern. I don't want to wipe it off the table, but we do know a lot about these drugs. We do know that they've been used in other countries for many years, and we've seen the profiles over there. It's the social and ethical implications of this drug that bother me more than the safety issues, and I think that case can be made. In fact, some of my colleagues who sat on the FDA panel that looked at this, you know, they came to that conclusion, too. They looked at all the data. The safety issues, yes, there's legitimate concerns, but it's not the big concern. The ethical concern about this product is the deception in which it's being marketed. If the FDA allows for this product to be sold as a contraceptive, and it says very clearly in the literature that this doesn't affect pregnancy and doesn't cause abortion.
How can they say that?
The only way they can say that is to redefine what a pregnancy means. And the medical community has been doing that for the last 30 years, starting back in 1972, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology redefined pregnancy to begin at implantation. Now, even in later years, back in 1994, the college toyed with the idea of trying to redefine pregnancy to begin 14 days after fertilization, calling those first 2 weeks a pre-embryonic time, which is not really pregnancy. And because of this shifting definition of pregnancy, that's the only way that they don't pass the smirk test, by the way, when they say this. Because, you know, there's so many people in our society hold fast to the idea that life is to be protected from the moment the fertilization occurs, when there's a unique genetic code, which if left uninterrupted is going to result in a child. And so many people hold fast to that. It is unethical and even immoral for the medical communities to sit there and tell them that this doesn't affect pregnancy when they know that they hold fast to that belief. And we know that this drug, in order to work at least some of the time, has to have post-fertilization effects. And when I debate this with my colleagues, nobody out there will deny that this drug has post-fertilization effects in order to be effective. Now, most of the time, we want it to inhibit ovulation. But when you take it right on top of ovulation, you know that egg's going to be released, you know fertilization is going to take place, and you know that something else is happening to prevent that fertilized egg, that new life, from implanting and growing. And for those of us who hold fast to life principles, that's an abortion. Now, I don't use that term abortion when I'm debating my colleagues. I just say, does it have post-fertilization effects? Yes. If that's important to the patient, shouldn't they be informed of it? And that's where all the stammering gets starting. There's no way to justify, it's totally unethical to provide informed consent that's only important for you. You have to provide informed consent that's important to the patient and may have an outcome in that patient's decision-making.
What do you make of the FDA's track record on, I'm thinking about the fast-tracking of RU486 that took place about 3 years ago now. What do you make of their track record when it comes to issues like this?
Well, you know, there's a lot of ideologies being promoted, and sometimes people just turn their minds off to the science, and I'm afraid the FDA has fallen prey to that. I think this is going to be a bit of a litmus test to see if under the current culture in Washington, whether the FDA is going to approve the morning after pill being over-the-counter. It's going to be very difficult for the new commissioner there, Dr. Martin McClellan, to ignore the advisory panel, which voted to approve it. It's going to take a lot of chutzpah on his part to overturn that or to ignore that and not approve it. But that'll be a real test for me as to whether there's a change in values at the FDA. My prediction, sadly, is that they're going to approve it.
And if it's approved, what would it take to have the FDA reverse itself on a decision like this or reconsider?
You know, with the large amount of safety concerns associated with RU-46 and the fact that we have been waging that battle before and after the approval process to get the FDA now to overturn that with all the trauma that's been caused by that drug, including the Holly Patterson case. And they have not made a decision yet, but they're dragging their feet and probably don't want to make this decision. I think it would just be near impossible to overturn the release of the morning after pill over the counter. 33 countries in the world do it. If you look at their statistics, the sexually transmitted diseases are going up. The men in Thailand are the most common purchasers, and they use it as a lever to obtain sexual favors. You understand how that works?
So they have it in hand before the sexual encounter and to say to the woman, here's a pill and there are no consequences.
Right. They're trying to say that we can eliminate the consequences. You just take this pill and give me what I want.
Dr. Gene Rudd, thank you very much for your time, for your work there at the Christian Medical Association, and for being our guest.
You're welcome.
Dr. Gene Rudd, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. Here's their website. It's cmdahome.org. cmdahome.org. Now, when we come back from this break, open lines for 90 minutes. First question I'm going to lay on the table for you after we hear a bit from George W. Bush during his appearance on Meet the Press on Sunday. The first question is religious freedom. The president seems confident that there will be religious freedom in the future Iraq. How important is that to you, especially judging the merit of the war? Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Open Lines is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.